I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. The National Trust for Historic Preservation found that nearly 70% of Philadelphia's buildings were built in 1945 or before, but only 2.2% of them have been given historic designation, protecting them from demolition. That's about half the national average. Philadelphia has also been undergoing a construction boom in recent years in Center City and the surrounding neighborhoods, driven by the demand for residential and commercial properties, and that has put some valuable and vulnerable buildings at risk. Can the city find that balance between preservation and development to meet the needs of a growing modern city while holding on to the unique architecture and historic character that makes Philadelphia Philadelphia. We want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email. I already see them coming in. radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me introduce our three guests. And here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Paul Stenke, Executive Director of the Preservation Alliance of Greater Philadelphia. He was the General Manager of the Reading Terminal Market and Finance Director for the Center City District. Paul, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us is Leo Adamando, and he's managing partner, co-founder of Altera Property Group. He's also vice president of the Building Industry Association and a board member of the Preservation Alliance of Greater Philadelphia. Leo Adamando, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me this
morning. You're welcome. And joining us by telephone is Harris Steinberg. He's executive director of the Lindy Institute for Urban Innovation at Drexel University. He's also chair of Mayor Kenney's Historic Preservation Task Force. Harris Steinberg, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty.
Let me start with a sort of overall question, and then we'll break it into bits and pieces as we go along. And Harris, let me begin with you. Can Philadelphia be a city that has historic preservation and support this construction boom?
Absolutely. I mean, Philly traditionally has been able to kind of elegantly live with new construction as well as the old. And I think what we're trying to do is figure out at the dawn of the 21st century, what are the tools we need, what works, what doesn't, that can enable a kind of seamless integration of new and old. And the task force is really kind of getting down into details, and I'm hopeful that the recommendations we put forward will be able to enable that kind of coexistence.
And I'll get back to that. But Paul, if just 2.2% of buildings in Philadelphia have this historic designation from the National Trust for Historic Preservation, is the city doing enough?
Well, just to clarify, the 2.2% refers to the percentage of buildings that are protected under the city of Philadelphia's preservation ordinance. And you're right that that's about half the national average for the 50 largest cities in the United States, which leaves roughly 98% of the buildings standing in Philadelphia vulnerable to a demolition permit and to destruction. And with the building boom we've been seeing, which is primarily housing-focused, townhouses in neighborhoods like Roxborough and Penzport and Graduate Hospital, and student housing around the universities, Temple, Drexel, where Harris is, and Penn, there have been increasing numbers of instances where developers target unprotected buildings that the community feels are important and demolishing them to build new construction housing.
Is that an unfair fight?
Well, I think a lot of us feel that way because, you know, the only tool we have to protect these buildings is historic designation under the city's preservation ordinance. And only 2% of the buildings are designated. And it's hard to get buildings added to the register, as it should be, because you're constraining its future to some degree. You have to go through a very arduous nomination process, two committees, plus the staff at the Historical Commission initially has to review it. So it can take 3, 6, 9 months to a year to get a single building added to the historic register. And in a city where half a million property or buildings are now standing and only about 12,000 are designated, that, as I say, leaves 98% vulnerable.
Let me turn to you, Leo, as vice president of the Building Industry Association. Does the association have a position on this balancing act about development and preservation?
I'm not sure that the BIA per se has a position. I'm on the Preservation Task Force along with one of the staff members of the Preservation Alliance, and obviously Harris is the chair of that. I guess representing the BIA, you know, our objective is really just to make sure that some basic sense of fairness and property rights are really taken into account in the conversation of how do we balance, you know, the need for development and really growth and the continued, you know, shall we say, upward swing the city is in, along with preserving not only buildings but also neighborhood fabrics. And, you know, Philadelphia being not only probably the most historic city in this country but also really a city of neighborhoods if ever there was one, the building fabric is sort of part and parcel of that neighborhood fabric. And so it's a tough balancing act. I will say that developers, you know, generally speaking, you know, we're subject to a certain set of laws. You know, there's property rights, there are codes, there are lots of ordinances that we as developers have to sort of navigate our way through. And the historic ordinances are part of those. Whether they're adequate or inadequate, there are certain laws on the books. And, you know, you as a developer have to sort of take those into account and work through those. And the way it's set up today, some buildings are protected and some are not. So I think when you start talking about how do you grow the base of protected buildings and what does that do to development and what does that do to property rights, it's a complex issue.
Well, Harris, let me go back to you. And what is the criteria for designating something either historic or worth preserving? And is it just because it's old, or is there something else at play? And I guess we should say that it's the Philadelphia Historical Commission that makes that final determination. But Harris, how should we see these buildings?
That's a great question, and in many ways I think it gets to the crux of the conversation. So the commission has specific criteria that they use to judge and adjudicate whether or not a building is eligible for listing on the Philadelphia Register of Historic Places. And it's a fairly kind of wide berth that the community is given, unlike kind of a more stricter definition of historic buildings, where we can encompass sites, cultural kind of people who were involved in significant cultural movements in the city and in buildings that were not necessarily of historic or architectural importance, objects such as the statue in the middle of 30th Street Station. Mm. So we have pretty wide latitude in terms, and we can create districts as well. So we can look through the lens of preservation at a lot of different pieces across the landscape that are not just about buildings. That said, as Paul noted, it is a fairly kind of rigorous application process. The upside is anybody can make an application to designate a building, site, object, or the like. So we have, again, a flexible ordinance. We have, I think, a very good ordinance, and we have some very strong tools for designation. What we don't have, and what the task force is really focusing on right now, is a way for neighborhoods and citizens and activists to really work in preservation but outside of the ordinance. So we're focusing a lot on what does it mean to neighborhoods like Tacony, Mount Airy, or others in the city that have significant identity as a place but are not necessarily they don't necessarily have the capacity or the interest of going for full designation as a district or going one by one through a neighborhood and designating properties. And that's where we're putting a lot of focus on right now. We're thinking of something called a preservation district that would be different from a conservation district, which is currently allowed by the zoning code, that could help conserve form and texture and rhythm and scale without it meeting the high bar that is often needed to meet the criteria for designation on the Philadelphia Register of Historic Places. So, long answer, but I'm hoping to sort of tease apart some of the nuances that we're getting into right now and not putting all the onus on the ordinance or the commission to enact preservation in Philadelphia.
Well, let me ask a very basic and practical question. I'll put this to you, Paul. Let's say I'm a homeowner in Philadelphia. I'm an older person. I'm on a fixed income. I live in an older house that maybe has some of these architectural details that are worth saving. I have a roof that needs to be repaired. I've got a porch that needs to be repaired. What does someone do if they want to particularly preserve their own property and they don't necessarily have the wherewithal to be able to do that?
Well, that gets to the question of a basic understanding of what historic designation means. But before I address that, I just want to point out, I don't think it's preservation versus development. I think preservation is development. And when a building is rehabilitated or adapted to a new use, it creates construction jobs and permanent jobs. For example, the Divine Lorraine on North Broad Street, which was a vacant shell, it was a $70 million investment to restore it. That's development. It's also preservation. But to get to your question, many homeowners or many citizens don't realize what historic designation really means. Mm-hmm. It only protects the exterior of the building unless the interior is specifically nominated. And we only have three instances where an interior has been nominated or designated. The former family court at 18th and Vine near the Parkway, parts of City Hall, and then the Preservation Alliance recently nominated the Grand Court of John Wanamaker's department store, now Macy's. But other than that, designation only protects the mm-hmm. exterior, but it does not compel homeowners or property owners to do anything unless they're seeking to make improvements. When they go get their building permit, which everyone has to do no matter what, they also have to go see the staff at the Historical Commission and get approval for their project. But it does not compel them to change windows, to clean the facade, to do anything once a building is designated, only when they want to make a change.
But do they get tax credits? Do they get tax abatements? I mean, in many ways, developers, they get some incentives in order to be able to either tear down or put up buildings in Philadelphia. Do homeowners get those same?
Well, as Harris and Leo know, there is on the Mayor's Task Force on Historic Preservation an incentives committee, and that was created because there really are no incentives for preservation. If a building is designated, the property owner really only gets bragging rights. And there's some data that shows that maybe in some cases there's an increase in property value. But in other cities, there are real incentives for having your building placed on the historic register, whether it be a tax abatement of some kind or waivers of license and permit fees for rehabilitation. Baltimore is a great example of a city that gives a 20% or a 10% tax credit when a building in a local or national historic district is rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, at the moment, Philadelphia does not yet have that, but we're hoping through the task force process we're going to get there.
We're going to take a very short break. Let me just read a couple of comments that came in right at the top of the show. Ron from Folsom, always very impressed with the refurbishment of the Lip Brothers building, but disappointed with the electronic billboard on the roof. I don't think Times Square is a good look for Philadelphia. Jennifer, who works in West Philadelphia, part of the charm and character of Philadelphia is the green town, houses with small yards, street trees and sunlight. The new construction builds out to the sidewalk, doesn't leave room for a blade of grass. How can we preserve landscape, not just historic buildings? Well, we are talking about historic preservation here in Philadelphia with Paul Stenke, Leo Adamando, and Harris Steinberg. You can join us. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, as those people did, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we're talking today about finding that balance between preservation and development in Philadelphia, discussing how the Mayor's Task Force on Historic Preservation is tackling that problem or is part of this ongoing process of tackling that problem, also talking about how and who should decide which buildings are worth saving. Paul Stenke, Executive Director of the Preservation Alliance of Greater Philadelphia, Leo Adamando, Managing Partner, Co-Founder of Altera Property Group, and Harris Steinberg, Chair of Mayor Kenney's Historic Preservation Task Force. Leo, let me talk to you about, and I looked at some of the buildings that you have worked on. We're talking about, in many ways, adaptive reuse. How does that work, and what are the pros, I guess, pros and cons of that?
So adaptive reuse is really just a fancy way of saying taking generally an older building or a building that is underutilized, changing the use of it. A common example would be taking an office building or an industrial building, in this case in Philadelphia, and turning it into housing, potentially some commercial space on the ground floor, and everything in between. It's a process that takes some knowledge of the fabric of the building itself and different buildings from different periods have sort of different characteristics, different building materials, if it's a historic building, which a lot of cases it is, there are also historic considerations, local considerations, national considerations. A lot of the larger adaptive reuse projects in Philadelphia have taken advantage of federal historic tax credits, but they also could take advantage of state historic tax credits, which are not always available in Pennsylvania. They're intermittently available. We've only taken advantage of them once over the years. There's also a program where you can donate a preservation easement on the mostly the outside, but also the inside of the building. The Preservation Alliance is the local sort of custodian of those easements, and we have several easements that the Alliance oversees. And those easements last in perpetuity. So you basically donate the sort of the rights to the outside of the building, in layman's terms, to the custodian, and they make sure that you maintain it over time. And you get a federal tax benefit for that. All these incentive programs are not Philadelphia specific. They're available to pretty much all buildings built before a certain date in the U.S.
If you didn't have those incentives, would it make sense to do what you do?
I would say that the tax incentives around adaptive reuse and historic preservation rehabilitation of buildings is an important important tool in not only preservation, but also in the development of historic buildings. As Paul mentioned, the Preservation Task Force is looking at other incentives, very much local incentives, that could be put in place. Unfortunately, the city doesn't have those incentives on the books today, and also state law puts some limitations around some of the things that could be done. You know, for example, there's been discussion of taking the 10-year tax abatement and potentially expanding it to a longer period of time for historic buildings. State law doesn't allow for that, for example. So part of the challenge I think that the task force has, it's many challenges, but part of the challenges that it has, specifically speaking to incentives, is trying to work within the state law and city law and also municipal finances to try to find incentives that don't take money from somewhere else, you know, because that becomes problematic.
Harris, let me go to you. And my understanding is that the task force was started in response to Toll Brothers deciding to tear down a number of buildings on Jewelers Row. My understanding is the oldest Jewelers Row in the country. First of all, is that correct? And did the city put those buildings in some kind of jeopardy?
Great question. So my understanding is no, it was not precipitated by Jewelers Row, although it did seem to coincidentally happen around that time. Mayor Kenney made a campaign pledge to focus on historic preservation, and when he announced the task force last April, that really is kind of how he framed the objective and the work of the task force and sort of that broader vision around kind of preservation, adaptive reuse, and balancing preservation and new development. That said, Jewelers Row became in many ways a cause celeb for many in the preservation community as well as the development community, and became, I think, a way for us to kind of have an acute kind of view into where the kind of challenges are. From my perspective, Jewelers Row is less of a preservation issue and more one of zoning and planning. It's an unintended consequence of our changing the zoning code that allowed for the increased density in that part of the city, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but in that particular block, you can question whether it is appropriate. So what you're pointing towards, which I believe is really in many ways sort of the larger question and objective that we should be reaching for, is how do we coordinate planning, development, historical commission, art commission, redevelopment authority, all of the parts and pieces of the city government that touch on the built environment and often interface with preservation. At the moment, there is no coordination between those kind of parts of working government. With the new Department of Planning and Development, with the Historic Commission now under that staff, the staff of the Historic Commission under that new department, therein lies, I believe, the opportunity to avoid the kind of issue that we have seen on Jewelers Row.
You want to speak to that, Paul?
To the issue of?
Well, first of all, it sounds like there's a lot of bureaucracy involved, and there are a lot of government departments and Preservation Alliance, Historic Association, all of those players that have a place at the table. And does that make preservation more difficult?
Well, I think we have to step back and think about what kind of city we want to be. You know, Philadelphia is, I would argue, the most historic city in the United States. I don't care what Boston says. I don't care what Charleston says. This is where it all began. And we did, a previous generation did a really good job recognizing the importance of the colonial and federal era landmarks that tell the story of American independence. And so you go to Independence Mall and Society Hill, and you'll find the colonial city pretty much intact. Where we've not done as good a job is telling the story of the era that made put Philadelphia on the map as a metropolis, and that was the Industrial Revolution and the workshop of the world, the Victorian era that gave us churches, schools, factory buildings that made Philadelphia one of the wealthiest and largest cities in the country. We have really not done a good job in recognizing that and preserving it, although there are plenty of good examples of factories that have been adaptively reused, neighborhoods.
You're pointing to Leo next to you.
Yeah, you can't see it on the radio. I'm pointing to Leo because he's done a lot of it. The Rittenhouse Square neighborhood is a local historic district built in the Victorian era. But as we said at the beginning, vast tracts of the city that were built during that era are vulnerable. And so we have to decide what kind of city we want to be and try to coordinate all the city agencies that govern that to help us achieve that goal.
Well, I'm thinking of Kensington, not so much the Kensington that's under development, but the Kensington that I remember when I worked there as a case manager in the 1970s. And you had these hulking factories, and you had lots of row houses. You had, in many ways, struggling communities, people trying to sort of hold their family and their livelihood together. What does preservation do for these people? I'm looking at you, Paul.
Well, so a neighborhood like Kensington, you're right, after being one of the centers of our workshop of the world,
exactly,
in the textile industry, global economic forces changed that forever and left us with empty factories and an impoverished neighborhood. And so I think preservation can be a tool for helping to revitalize those neighborhoods by helping to rebuild them out of the bones of the former industrial city. And so we have many examples of former factories that have been turned into apartments for low to moderate income people, for veterans, for programs, I'm thinking along Diamond Street in North Philadelphia, to convert once grand Victorian homes for wealthy families into apartments for low to moderate income people. We have good examples that we can point to and that we can replicate by using the existing building stock, which is not to say there isn't room for new construction and new designs. I mean, there's plenty of vacant land in this city, too, to build new as well and have a sort of a national model of the mixing of the old and the new.
We are talking about preservation and development in Philadelphia. That's Paul Stenke, Executive Director of the Preservation Alliance of Greater Philadelphia. Leo Adamando, Managing Partner, Co-Founder of Altera Property Group. And he's also Vice President of the Building Industry Association. They're with us here in our Philadelphia studio. Harris Steinberg joining us by telephone, Chair of Mayor Kenney's Historic Preservation Task Force. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. So, Leo, what do you, as you look at some of these more struggling neighborhoods, more low-income neighborhoods, what are the options that the builders and developers see there? And, you know, I looked at a number of the buildings that you've done, and they're, I mean, they're beautiful. And they look like they're places that pretty well-off people would enjoy living in. What do we do for the fact that 25% of the people in Philadelphia are low-income and many are struggling as well? What does preservation and even development do for these people?
Well, I can't say that I necessarily speak from experience and that we don't do a lot in sort of the outer ring of the city and in some of the less developed parts of the city. But I guess in my role at the BIA, one of the things that we're looking at is sort of the housing and affordability issue in Philadelphia. And that dovetails, I think, nicely with historic preservation in certain neighborhoods where the existing building stock is certainly the most economically feasible and efficient way to create and preserve additional housing for a lot of the disadvantaged, you know, whether they be the 25% of the people in the city who live under poverty or the folks who live just above that poverty line and still are housing cost burdened. So historic preservation in general When it's done in a coordinated way, you know, with certain incentives and with the support of city government and also with the support of private industry, private developers, is a great way. It's a great tool that can be used to help solve some of the housing problems that we have in the city. There's the shortage of affordable, you know, of safe, affordable, you know, housing that we need in the city. I'd say in the neighborhoods that are not necessarily in greater center city where you haven't seen a lot of development, in a lot of cases, unfortunately, the existing housing stock and its historic character, you know, comes into conflict with the economic forces of how do I cost effectively take an old building and convert it into a you know, a suitable living unit. I think this is where Paul and I have a lot of common ground and wanting to see some city programs implemented that specifically target those neighborhoods whose historic fabric is part of the solution to the housing problem, not you know, part of the problem.
Let me read some more email. And Harris, I'll toss this to you. An email from Tara. Thank you for featuring this subject. The Pennsylvania Ballet is demolishing a lovely terracotta structure on North Broad, which is experiencing increased support for revitalization. The owner's excuse is it cannot be saved. Then Tara goes on to say, New York supports its historic structures by installing vigorous preservation laws and oversight. Why can't Philadelphia do this? Harris, is this something on your to-do list?
Well, I would say broadly, yes, not necessarily that building in particular, but the question, I think, is how can we kind of broaden, as I said at the top of the program, kind of participation in preservation in Philadelphia that perhaps is even outside of how the Historical Commission and the current ordinance kind of creates the framework for. So undoubtedly, that building is not on the register. Of historic places in Philadelphia.
It's not.
She, as a citizen, can start that nomination process if she feels it's an important building and it has the attributes and or the history to kind of qualify. So there is a vehicle for Tara as a citizen to do that. And as Paul said, it's not easy, but it's available. So one of the things that we're trying to kind of focus on is what tools do we have in Philadelphia now? What's working? What are we not using enough of? And how can we kind of galvanize not only the citizenry, but perhaps bring more manpower within the city in this new kind of coordinated Department of Planning and Development to bear on historic resources and the preservation kind of environment? The other thing, as I mentioned also at the top of the program, is this kind of question of are there other types of in this case, districts that we could create in Philadelphia that are not necessarily adjudicated by the Historical Commission, that are different from the conservation districts, which really don't deal with historic properties, and the zoning code that allow citizens to determine what's important in their communities and how they would like to steward them into the future. It's not going to help this building tomorrow, but those are kind of some of the pieces that we're looking at that may broaden the field in terms of expanding beyond the ordinance and bringing more people into the preservation stewardship role.
Paul, let me go back to you. You mentioned Society Hill, which is what? That's a historic...
Society Hill is both a National Register Historic District, which, by the way, does not impose any restrictions on property ownership, and a local Philadelphia Historic District that was enacted, I think, in 1999. In that case... property owners do need to seek Historical Commission approval for any major changes to their buildings.
You have also said that Germantown, I believe, is the oldest neighborhood in the country. I think I read that correctly, or certainly one of the oldest neighborhoods. Also, Spruce Hill in West Philadelphia. Are these parts of Philadelphia that we should take a deeper look at?
We certainly should. I'll start with Spruce Hill. I mentioned in my opening about student housing development pressure around the universities, and Spruce Hill is ground zero for that. And although Spruce Hill was proposed as a local historic district back in the 90s, it was never enacted. Spruce Hill is also said to be the largest collection of Victorian-era housing in any city in the U.S. Architect design, blocks of twins and row houses punctuated by churches and schools and other landmarks. Most of it not designated, most of it vulnerable. And so what we've been seeing, and that's the neighborhood I live in, is buildings that are active in use, occupied, tax-paying buildings being acquired by developers demolished and replaced with larger apartment buildings that have more units in them. So from a strict business standpoint, it's a good move. But from the standpoint of what kind of city we want to be and the historical integrity of Spruce Hill, which is so precious, and every one of those buildings that we lose will never be built again. It's tragic, and it has our friends in Spruce Hill and the University City Historical Society really upset and scrambling to try to get ahead of it.
We had someone comment some of this new construction in West Philly, and she says it's taken away, you know, of the blades of grass. Are there, maybe I can toss that to you, Leo. We're almost up on our second break here, but what's the responsibility of a developer to, even if there is no historic designation, but just to the look of a neighborhood?
Well, I think that, you know, developers need to be careful in how far they take the argument that a building is beyond salvaging, beyond repair, beyond, you know, their ability to economically make the adaptive reuse viable. There's a lot of sort of leaning into the building is too far gone on the part of developers these days. I also want to say that we should be very careful not to draw parallels to New York City. New York City has a much more robust economy than Philadelphia, and the economics of real estate development in New York City are so much greater than Philadelphia that looking at New York's Landmark Commission and all the historic preservations they have, and it's very robust in New York. It is very difficult to redevelop and almost impossible to tear down a historic building in New York City. The economics of that are so different. The local context is so different. We shouldn't look at New York City. It's not a good example for Philadelphia.
Plus, the rents, I mean, they're just sky high compared to Philly. It's just off the Richter scale.
Part of why they can preserve older buildings that are in much worse condition than we can in Philadelphia.
Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me just reintroduce our guest, Harris Steinberg, joining us by telephone, Executive Director of the Lindy Institute for Urban Innovation at Drexel University. He's also the chair of Mayor Kenney's Historic Preservation Task Force. Also with us and here in our Philadelphia studio, Leo Adamando, Managing Partner, co-founder of Altera Property Group. He's also Vice President of the Building Industry Association. He happens to be a board member of the Preservation Alliance of Greater Philadelphia. Paul Stenke is Executive Director of the Preservation Alliance. And we are talking about preserving important buildings in Philadelphia and finding this balance between preservation and development and what it takes to retain Philadelphia's unique architecture and its unique historic character. 1-888-477-9499. Let me read an email from Miguel. He says, I'd like your guest to address the current demolition of the Chocolate Factory on Washington Avenue, the last Civil War era building in Philadelphia at the hands of OCF Realty. Developments in nearby Point Breeze by OCF are breaking the fabric of the neighborhood by creating block by block economic disparity reinforced by tax abatement for new construction. Taxes rise and tenants have to leave. Miguel goes on to say, how can the Preservation Alliance and builders help keep the fabric of the surrounding neighborhoods while building for a new city and new residents? Harris, let me get you to weigh in on that, and I know our other guests will as well. Using that as an example, and I think Miguel outlines that really well.
Yeah. From what I know of the case, I mean, it does sound like it's an unfortunate circumstance and a loss that could have been prevented. One of the issues that I think is driving this, although I don't know for sure, but it's something that I think Leo and I believe Paul has also touched on, which is that the tax abatement in Philadelphia really in many ways does not favor preservation. The economics favor tearing down a building and building anew as opposed to preserving what's there. And that's part of the discussions we've been having, particularly with folks in the incentive community, is how can the tax abatement, which has been incredibly successful in helping to drive development in Philadelphia, actually be a useful tool for preservation as opposed to an impediment. So I believe it's a loss for Washington Avenue. We've seen plenty of examples around the country, if not around the world, where you can add to an existing building, build above something like the Chocolate Works, Chocolate Factory, and really integrate it in a way that where there's a seamless connection between modernity and history. But what we're going to kind of now see, I think, will be just a new building. I haven't seen what it looks like yet, so I can't comment on that, but one that does not benefit from the connection to history.
Miguel goes on to say, talking about this Point Breeze part of Philadelphia, the aesthetics of these constructions are plastic. They're cheap-looking and jarring in the context of surrounding brick facades. This has happened in Fishtown, Northern Liberties, and Graduate Hospital. Paul, you want to wait?
Marty, can I add one thing?
Sure.
So one thing that's been on my mind lately is, and it gets back to the comment I made earlier about the lack of coordination across agencies in Philadelphia, all of them doing their job and doing them well, but not necessarily coordinating towards a higher vision to what kind of city we want to be, as Paul said, and how does preservation fit into that. Los Angeles just created a position called the Chief Design Officer for the City of Los Angeles, and they hired the former architecture critic of the Los Angeles Times to really, at the mayoral level, kind of look across kind of the city as a whole, and that's a much larger city, obviously, both physically and population-wise, but is sending the signal that design, as widely as we want to define it, is important kind of to the identity of the city, and that's a role we don't really have here in Philadelphia. People have played that role at times. Alan Greenberger, when he was the deputy mayor, in many ways kind of played that role. Ed Bacon, of course, did quite famously in the 50s and 60s. But it does get to this larger question of what kind of city do we want to be, and how does design writ large kind of play into achieving that image?
Paul, you want to weigh in on Chocolate Factory and what Harris just said?
Sure. I guess with the Chocolate Factory, I want to start by saying, you know, Philadelphia used to be a national leader in the conversion of vacant industrial buildings into apartments. Historic Landmarks for Living, led by the late Steve Solms, along with the still very active Carl Dranoff, remade Old City. In fact, there's a Chocolate Factory there that's been apartments for 30 years, not far from where we're sitting. But the Chocolate Factory on Washington Avenue, it looked like it was going to be a preservation success story as recently as the beginning of this year. It was added to the National Register of Historic Places by the prior owner in December. It was nominated for the local historic register in January. But then the developer decided to sell to the current owner, who had a very different vision for the property. And he was able to persuade the city and the Department of Licenses and Inspections that the building was imminently dangerous. We pleaded with the city to allow us to bring in another engineer to get a second opinion. And I don't want to second guess our Department of License and Inspections. They take their responsibilities very seriously. But they did determine that the building was a danger to the public and decided to issue the demolition permits at the end of April. And that very same week that the permits were issued, which was the week before last, the demolition began. So instead of getting an apartment conversion of a full block Civil War era industrial complex that would have been 150 apartments and 20 townhouses, we're going to get something else. So that battle was lost. I think we, you need to learn that lesson. And I would hope that if it ever comes up again, we do have the opportunity to get a second opinion, because the building was nominated to the Philadelphia Register and was theoretically protected from demolition. And that's what we thought until the building started to be pulled apart.
Let me read some more comments. One from Noel: we fought years to get Engine 46 on local register. Parts of city government work with developers rather than with citizens. A tweet from DeWitt: can your panel address the 10-year abatement's role in incentivizing teardowns and whether it should be changed to incentivize preservation? I think something that we have touched on. You both responded to Engine 46. Leo, anything new? No? That was you, Paul.
I just wanted to say, that building did have an active demolition permit from 2013 on, but that permit expired, and that enabled us, according to the preservation ordinance, to nominate that building for the historic register, and it was added to the historic register in 2017. So that building is now saved. And we're now entertaining, along with the property owner, some ideas for how to reuse it.
Leo, Paul, I think, mentioned the fact that there's a lot of vacant land in Philadelphia, and that's certainly true. Lots of abandoned houses as well. Do developers, is it really just Center City and the neighborhoods that hug Center City? Is that just where, I mean, that's where you see a lot of the cranes and a lot of the construction and detours and things like that. Is that just the hot, these are where the hot properties are in Philadelphia?
Well, I think certainly the closer you are to Center City and the core of the city, the more valuable the real estate is, the more kind of interest that'll garner from developers and the like. But my firm really focuses more on Center City and a little bit on Greater Center City. I will say that we've looked outside of that footprint, and places like Mantua, even Strawberry Mansion, going north of Kensington into Port Richmond, certainly a place like Pennsport, you didn't see any development there 10 years ago, and now you've got, you know, $700,000 homes being built, but also $300,000 or $400,000 renovations being done. So there are many, many, many parts of the city all the way down, you know, all the way down to the stadiums, you know, and as far, far west, you know, west of Spruce Hill, and going, you know, northwest past Mantua and north into North Philadelphia, and then skipping, you know, to Roxborough and Manayunk and places like that. Most of the city at this point in time is seeing interest from developers, whether it's in historic properties or vacant land.
Let me get more. It looks like Maurice from Southwest Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Maurice, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I'm the president of the Garden Court Community Association, and we work a lot with the developers with trying to keep preservation in our area. And Paul has been a great stalwart of preservation in our area. My question is, how does us being designated as the only city in the United States as a World Heritage City affect preservation?
Maurice, it's a terrific question. Let me just toss that first to Harris Steinberg, and then looks like, Paul, you want to respond as well. But Harris, does that make a difference?
It makes a difference in terms of identity and branding and bragging rights, but it has no bearing whatsoever on local designation or protection of specific properties, buildings, or districts.
I think where that designation has been important is that it has raised awareness among Philadelphians of the international importance of our historic assets. The reason we got that designation is because we have a UNESCO World Heritage Site, which is Independence Hall. But the folks who at the Global Philadelphia Association who've been promoting that designation have tried to pivot off of just that one structure to highlight the historic and cultural assets of the entire city and region. Mm. And they've done a great job. They're partners of ours, and I think they have helped to make us all more aware. But to get to Maurice's comment, and Maurice is a neighbor, I'm a dues-paying member of Garden Court Community Association, former treasurer of the board, full disclosure. Garden Court is another neighborhood that has great historic assets, none of which are protected in almost any way.
Let me read an email from Sue, and I think this speaks to a lot of what we've been talking about. She says, Germantown is a much different economic picture than Center City, so it seems that in a cost-benefit analysis, demolition may always win in the current climate. Our little neighborhood alone has nearly 100 historic properties. Even though residents are in favor of preservation, they aren't wealthy people and could use some financial assistance in stabilizing their historic properties and specialized technical assistance in knowing the best methods to do that. The commission underway doesn't seem to adequately be addressing the middle income preservationists. Harris, I'm going to toss that back in your lap. Is she right?
She is right. I mean, and it's really in many ways not the job of the commission to finance repairs for properties. We've talked about this a little bit on the program this morning, and the work of the incentives committee on the task force, I think, is going to begin to try to address some of these issues. How can we enable folks to stay in their homes, preserve them to whatever level is deemed appropriate, perhaps outside of the jurisdiction of the commission? There's a project called the Healthy Row House Project, which has been gotten a lot of attention both locally and nationally, around maintaining the row house as an incredibly sustainable kind of unit of domesticity, so to speak, but also integral to the identity of Philadelphia as a global city. And how can we, through partnerships as well as education, enable people to stay in those houses, get them the resources they need for a new furnace, for a new roof, for new windows, in a way that preserves the character of the neighborhood, but again, isn't necessarily driven by high preservation standards.
Leo, let me go back to you, and just broadly speaking, as a builder, a developer, when you look at a building, just, you know, here's a building that's, it's old, we'll just call it that. How do you make the determination about what is worth preserving? And I realize in many ways you're dealing with buildings that have already been designated that, but how do you think through that?
Marty, I'm going to answer that in a sec. To your question about the Germantown neighborhood and money for fixing homes, whether they're historic or not, the city does have a basic systems home repair program. You can get, I don't know if it's $10,000 or $15,000 per home. They just floated some bonds against it. So there is money out there for people to stay in their homes and fix their roofs and add furnaces and things of that sort. So there is a city program that speaks to that. To answer your question, our general philosophy is we try to never look at an old building and say, okay, we're going to start with tearing it down and then see what we can replace it with. Generally, when we're buying a building, we're buying it subject to some plan that makes economic sense to preserve it, to adaptively reuse it in some way, shape, or form. Certain types of buildings, certain eras of buildings tend to be easier to work with than others. Obviously, the more masonry construction, the less structural problems that you'll have. Things like schools, you know, classroom sizes approximate apartment sizes. It's one of the interesting, you know, kind of architectural, you know, things you learn along the way. Factories tend to have column spacing that works well for residential units. So there are certain types of buildings and certain eras of construction that I think lend themselves very well to conversion to other uses, be they residential, commercial, retail, you know, whatever the case may be. There's a certain expertise. It's not rocket science, but there's a certain expertise and a certain pattern recognition that people in the business of restoring old buildings into more productive uses, you know, that they pick up over time, where you walk into a building and you can tell pretty quickly whether or not it can and should be saved. I'm not making a value judgment. I'm saying just simply based on the structure and what you can do with it economically. So we tend to focus on the ones that we see pretty early on in the process, how it could be economically renovated into something, you know, that made sense for us, for, you know, as market rate developers.
I can't take Patrick's call, and he's calling us from Camden, but he says, the office has taken 3 years for my application for my house in Camden that Martin Luther King used to own. Why does it take so long? Are African-American properties less of a priority? Harris, if I can toss that to you, we're almost out of time here, but does it just, I mean, I realize there are a lot of agencies involved, but does it take too long?
I believe that was in the paper yesterday. That's a property in Camden, correct?
Yes, yes.
So I don't know the system in Camden at all. As Paul said, in Philadelphia, it can take 3 to 9 months, right, depending on the process. So it's certainly not 3 years. And from my experience on the commission, I've seen absolutely no evidence of discrimination, racially or otherwise, in terms of applicants or property.
I would second that.
And you would second that as well. Well, we are out of time. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Harris Steinberg, thanks so much.
A pleasure.
Executive Director of the Lindy Institute for Urban Renovation at Drexel University. He's chair.
Innovation, but that's a Freudian slip.
Urban Innovation. What did I? Okay. Urban Innovation at Drexel University. He's also chair of Mayor Kenney's Historic Preservation Task Force. Leo Adamondo, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well. Managing partner, co-founder of Altera Property Group, and also vice president of the Building Industry Association. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me today.
You're welcome. Paul Stenke is executive director of the Preservation Alliance of Greater Philadelphia. Paul, thanks for joining us.
I wish we had a second hour.
I do too.
Thank you.
We don't
have
that anymore. Thanks very much. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show. Go to iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Debbie Builder and John Ahrens are the Radio Times producers, with assistance today from Alex Stern. Diana Martinez, our engineer. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.